All right, Rebbe, say good morning. It is an incredible day today, incredible daf ahead of us today, and an incredible schos to be here and to be able to learn it with all of you. I once again want to give a very special thank you to Moshe Abramson, to Jeremy Lassen, who have really been working so incredibly hard in this setup. Their greatest challenge is me and my technical missteps. So I apologize because often my technical missteps cause them a bit more work. But really, Baruch Hashem, to think that we are we are up and running, Baruch Hashem, with such a sophisticated technology. And Baruch Hashem, we're just, you should know, because of them. I mentioned in a different shul last week, I had the great schus to speak to a Beis Yaakov in New Jersey because of them. So it's really like not ideal circumstances, but Baruch Hashem, nevertheless, an incredible schus to continue our learning biyachad. And again, that's very much thanks to Maishi and to Jeremy. So if you happen to be in touch with them or dialogue with them, please make sure to thank them. I want to thank the sponsors of this morning's shir. As soon as I pull it up, to thank our Talmud Torah sponsors for the month of Adar, the Lerner Mishpacha, for dedicating the learning in Shiurim this month in memory of Mrs. Dina Lerner Gerber, Dina Bas Yehuda Leib. To thank our week of learning sponsors, Paul and Kathy Pollack, for dedicating the learning this week in memory of Paul's grandparents, Zachariah ben Zachariah, Dina Bas Pesach. To thank Avi Zeisman for his dedication of the week of learning in memory of Avi's father, Michael ben Yechiel. And to thank our Dafyomi sponsors, Michael and Rivki Leichter, in honor of Morty, Malki, and Bezalel Tusk on Bezalel's Bar Mitzvah. Beautiful. Beautiful. We'll talk more about, put in the shul email about Bezalel's Bar Mitzvah. Bezalel Tusk was supposed to have his Bar Mitzvah this Shabbos. We will, Amir Tzashem, be conducting a very special Zoom Bar Mitzvah on Matzei Shabbos. I encourage all of you to come. Details, Amir Tzashem, to be sent out today. And I will say with that, let us begin. So a beautiful Gemara ahead of us today. We are picking up, like I said, today's daf is Yud Dalid, is 14. And we are picking up, Amir Tzashem, on Yud Gimel Amud Beis. We are picking up Amar Rav Yehuda, which is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 lines up from the bottom. So it says the Gemara, Amar Rav Yehuda Rav, Barom Zachar Osa Ishlatov, Vechananya ben Chizkiya Shmo. So Hananya ben Chizkiya is remembered for good. Right? How is he remembered for good? Why is he Zachar Latov? Ultimately, again, I'm sorry. So how is he Zachar Latov? How is he remembered for good? Shel Malehu Nignas Sefer Yecheskel. For were it not for the hard work of Hananya ben Yecheskel, ultimately again, were it not for the hard work of Hananya ben Chizkiya, the book of Yecheskel would have been hidden away. Why would the book of Yecheskel have been hidden away? Sheu Dvarav Sosrin Divrei Torah. Because apparently there were aspects in Sefer Yecheskel that ultimately were contradictory, and they seem to have contradicted different aspects of Torah. So what did Yecheskel, now of course, Yecheskel Anavi is not contradicting Torah, but some of the psukim were written in a very cryptic fashion. So because of that, they caused some level of confusion. So therefore, what did Hananya ben Chizkiya do? So the Gemara said, also what did he do? Hello, Gimel Meos Garbe Shemen. They brought up to his study, to his attic, 300 barrels of oil, the Yashav Ba'aliyah Vidarshan. And he sat in his attic and he darshaned and explained all of the different psukim. So we'll say, so the idea over here is, they brought up to his attic oil. So oil represents, first of all, oil for the light, and also food. So pretty much what he did was, what Hananya ben Chizkiya did was, he locked himself in his attic until he was able to go ahead and write out a perish on all of Sefer Yecheskel. And only then did he come out of the attic. So the Gemara says, were it not ultimately for Hananya ben Yecheskel, we would have had no choice but to go ahead and hide away hide away Sefer Yecheskel. Sorry, Hananya ben Chizkiya. We would have had to hide away Sefer Yecheskel because it would have posed too many theological complications. But you know, there's an incredible muster in this Gemara, and the incredible muster is that, you know, what Hananya ben Chizkiya did. If you think, why does the Gemara just say that Hananya ben Chizkiya went ahead and wrote a perish on Sefer Yecheskel? Right? Why do you have to tell me that he locked himself in his base, in his attic until he finished the whole perish? It's teaching us an incredible lesson that a lot of times in life, there's a problem that comes up and the problem has to be solved. If you really want to engage in serious problem solving, sit down and solve the problem and don't get up until the problem is solved. Because a lot of times what happens in life is we begin to do something and then we give it half attention or we get sidetracked. So the things we really know or we really feel we have to get done never really fully get done because they don't get our full attention. So Hananya ben Chizkiya realizes that there is a crisis with Sefer Yecheskel. So what does he do? 300 barrels of oil to the attic, and I'm not leaving until we work it out. An incredible mussar. Sometimes when something has to get done, clear your plate from everything else, set aside everything else, and deal with the most acute matters at hand. Incredible mussar. So the Gemara goes weiter. Shmona asar davar gazus. Remember again, the Mishnah was talking about the fact that the rabbis assembled in the attic of Hananya ben Chizkiya, and it is there that they decided 18 halachas. So now the Gemara is going to go through those 18 halachos. Says the Gemara, Bosse. Now the truth is, as we're going to see, the majority of them are related to that. Really, almost all of them are related to the halachos of Tumantara, ritual purity and impurity. So says the Gemara, Ma'inin hu shmona asar davar. I could almost hear the collective sigh, even though everybody's on mute. But it's okay. This is good Tumantara. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be enjoyable. So says the Gemara, here we go. Ma'inin hu shmona asar davar disnan elu post lines at truma. So we'll say, so what we're going to go through a list over here is of items that make truma possible. And I will say, remember again, tuma, ritual impurity, functions in different states. So, for example, the source of that, what we call like the avos hatuma, the paradigmatic example of tuma, is a corpse. So when you come in contact with a corpse, you contract tuma. A person can then transfer that tuma to different things and different items. The way that Hilchos Tuma works, for the most part, is that when you transfer ritual impurity from one person to another person, or from one thing to another thing, it generally goes down a level. Now, the truth is, for Truma, the lowest level that of Tuma that Truma could contract is what's called a Shlishi L'Tuma. We'll call it third degree Tuma, which means that you're 3 degrees removed ultimately from the source. That's not always a true definition, but for our illustrative purposes, say that's just fine. Truma, when it becomes a shlishi, no longer has the ability to go ahead and convey Tuma to anything else. But we don't call Truma. So at that point in time, what we call Truma is pasul, which means when Truma reaches the shlishi status, it's pasul in that, again, it has contracted Tuma, but it cannot convey Tuma to anything else. So says the Gemara, Elu Poslim and Satruma. These are items ultimately, again, that can go ahead and convey a shlishi level of Tuma to Truma, thereby making Truma pasul, unfit, invalid, but the Truma itself doesn't have the ability to convey Tuma to anything else. So let's go through the list. Says the Gemara, Ha'ochal ochal rishon. Person eats a food that is a rishon l'tuma, right? First degree tuma. So remember again, the way that would let's say you have a person who touched a corpse, and the person then touched a food item. That food item would become a rishon because the corpse. Now remember, corpse tuma is a little bit different, but that corpse is called avi avos hatuma, like the mothership of tuma. A person who touches the corpse is an av hatuma. Then a person who touches the food is then called a rishon. So if a person goes ahead, or the food is a rishon. A person goes ahead and eats a rishon, so what happens? And then he touches, or ha'ochal ochal sheni, or so we'll say a person eats a rishon and then he touches truma, that truma ultimately becomes pasul. A person goes ahead and eats sheni l'tuma, an item that is a sheni. So what's the, so remember, sheni, same idea, 2 degrees removed. So what's the halacha? Or v'hashosem mashkim, also makes truma tmeya. Hashosem mashkim tmeyin. If one goes ahead and drinks an item, drinks a drink that is tamei, drinks an item which is tamei, so halacha l'maisa again also, and then touches truma, makes truma pasul. And ultimately, again, if one goes ahead and essentially brings his head and the majority of his body under drawn water. So we'll say, we'll discuss exactly what this means, but it sounds like it's saying over here is as follows. If you pour water over your body, so you contract some level of tumah, again, we'll define the parameters of that, to the point that if you were to then go ahead and touch truma, the truma would become pasul. V'tahar, shenafla al rosho v'rubo shlosha lugin mayim shuvin. Similarly, again, if you have a person who's tahar, who didn't even intentionally, but let's say it occurred, that 3 lugin of water fell on his head and the majority of his body. If such a person were to go ahead and touch truma, he would become tamei. V'hasefer, if one touches a sefer Torah, So the truth is, we're going to see this is actually not just the Sefer Torah. All of their Sfarim, right? All of their Sifrei Tanakh were written ultimately in scroll form. So if a person touches the parchment of the scroll directly and then were to touch Truma, they would render the Truma pasul. V'hayadayim, stam yadayim, hands in general. Hands in general are considered to be tamei. Really, right, really like a sheni l'tumas, a second degree of tumah. And if you touch truma with unwashed hands, you render the truma unfit. Vayadan, v'tvulyom. Tvulyom, remember again, is a person who went to the mikvah by day, but still requires the setting of the sun in order to become tar. If such a person were to go ahead and touch truma, he would render the truma unfit. Va'ochlim v'hakelim shenitmu b'mashkin. Or if you have food or utensils, ultimately, again, which became tummy through contact with tummy liquid, ultimately, again, that also passes truma. So, we'll say now we're going to go through the list. Mantana, ha'ochel ochel rishon, va'ochel ochel sheni, mifsel psile, tamuye tap of yudalid, lomitamu. So, we'll say, who is the opinion who says that if you eat food which is a rishon, or you eat food which is a sheni, that this only results in making the truma a shlishi, but ultimately, again, not making the truma a sheni. What's interesting about this is as follows. What the Bryce has said over here is that if a person goes ahead and eats food which is a rishon, then becomes tame, and then subsequently goes ahead and touches truma, so he makes the truma a shlishi. So What happened over here? How is it that, remember, I would have thought using our logic that the truma under those circumstances would have become a sheni. So whose opinion is this? Amar Rabba Brachana Rabbi Yoshua. It's Rabbi Yoshua. Disnan Rabbi Eliezer Omer ha'ochel ochel rishon rishon va'ochel ochel sheni sheni ochel shlishi shlishi. So Rabbi Eliezer essentially says, you are what you eat. Right, if you go ahead and you eat an ochel, right, if you eat food, ultimately, again, that is a rishon, you become a rishon. You eat food that is a sheni, you become a sheni. You eat food that is a shlishi, you become a shlishi. And therefore, according to this logic, if you eat food that is a rishon, you become a rishon, you make truma a sheni. You eat food that is a sheni, you become a sheni, you make truma a shlishi. That is the opinion, ultimately, again, of Rabbi Eliezer. Conversely, Rabbi Yoshua says, ha'ochel ochel rishon ve'ochel sheni, sheni. Well, if one goes ahead and eats food which is a rishon or a sheni, by definition, that makes you a sheni. However, therefore, again, that's the opinion of our Mishnah. Or I should say, that's the opinion of the Braisa. That's the opinion that says that whether you eat food that is a rishon or a sheni, it makes you ultimately into a sheni status. He's not mechalik. Rabbi Yeshua is not mechalik between consumption of a rishon or a sheni. By definition, you become a sheni. Therefore, when you go out and you touch truma, you make that truma a shlishi. Once truma is a shlishi, it cannot convey tuma to anything else. That's why the word that we use for truma, which is a shlishi, is we use the word pasul. That's invalid. However, shlishi, what happens if a person goes ahead and consumes food? Which is, so Rashi points out the Svar for Rabbi Yehoshua, we're not going to get into it. What happens if you consume something that is a shlishi? So in that case, sheni lekodesh vein sheni lechuma. Ultimately, again, if a person consumes an item that is a shlishi, that makes him ultimately, again, a sheni for kodesh, but not a sheni for truma. Good. So therefore, I will say, the Braisa quoted reflects the opinion of Rabbi Yehoshua, who holds that there is no distinction between consumption of a Rishon or a Sheni. By definition, it makes you a Sheni. And therefore, whether you consume a food item that is a Rishon Latoma, a Sheni Latoma, that makes you a Sheni Latoma. And if you subsequently touch Truma, you've made the Truma into a Shlishi, and a Shlishi is called Pasel, says the Gemara. Bechulin, Gemara says, I'm sorry. Shlishi the kodesh. So the Gemara says, "Ve'ein sheni the truma bechulin shenasu al taras truma." And I will say ultimately again. So what is the case? What is the case of a shlishi food? To which the Gemara says, the case of a shlishi food could come up in one situation on chulin shenasu al taras truma. So if you go ahead and you prepare your chulin. If you prepare your chulin with the strictures, right, with the halachos of truma, ultimately, again, that is the shlishi case. Good. Ochal ochal rishon va'ochal ochal sheni my time magazu be'rabbanan tuma. So I'll say, this is very interesting. So remember, again, all of this that, well, not all of it, but these cases, these initial cases, seem to be dealing with rabbinic law, right? If you go ahead and you eat a rishon or you eat a sheni, you become a sheni and you make truma a shlishi. Why is it that the rabbis were gozer in that case? Why did the rabbis legislate in this particular scenario? My time goes to be rabbanan tumah. Listen to this. The zimnin, the achol ochlin tamein, the shakal mashkin the truma. What's the concern? Concern is as follows. Sometimes you're going to go ahead and eat food, which is tamein, and at the same time you're going to be drinking a drink of truma. So you're both saying, the concern over here is, essentially, I'm going to wash down tummy food with, let's say, truma wine. The shadi lipume, and I will say, all of this is going to go in my mouth together. Upasalahu, ultimately, again, and therefore I'm going to end up passeling the truma. So I will say, interestingly enough, what the Gemara seems to be saying is that halacha lemaisa, we are concerned about the truma contracting tuma, even where? Even in your mouth. Very interesting. So I'm concerned that a person is going to eat a food that is tamei, wash it down with a truma liquid, and ultimately, again, pasalahu. So Gemara says, shose mashkin tamein, my time agazu b'hu rabbanon. So we'll say, ultimately, again, in the case of drinking tamei liquids, why would rabbanon go there? So Gemara says, zimnin shose mashkin tamein, v'shakal ochlin the truma. Because conversely, we're also concerned about a case where a person drinks something tamei. Why is that? Because what we're concerned about is that they might have a circumstance where a person is drinking something tamei, but at the same time eating truma food, the shadi le lepume, and a person will throw everything together in his mouth, upasule, and ultimately again he will pasul it. To which the Gemara says, Hainuhach, you just repeated the same case twice. In other words, I will say, you just said case number one is that we're concerned ultimately again, right, about ochal ochal, the case of ochal ochal, of ochal ochal rishon, va ochal ochal sheni. That if you eat the rishon, you eat the sheni, you pass the truma, so what's the concern? So Gemara says, there are two concerns. Concern number one is that you may end up going ahead and drinking. Right, you may go ahead and eat tummy food and essentially go ahead and drink truma liquid. And they're going to combine together in your mouth and you passel the truma liquid. And there's a second concern. What's the second concern? That you may drink tummy liquids, eat truma food, and they may combine together in your mouth and you'll passel the truma food. So Mara says, you just said the same thing twice. The only thing you did is you just switched which one was truma. In concern number one, the truma was the liquid. In case number two, the concern was truma of a food. So what's the chilek? So watch this. Mal de tema, hashrichi v'haloshrichi. So you'll say, I might have thought as follows. One case is common, one case is not. Well, it's actually very interesting. This gives you a window a little bit into Talmudic meal etiquette. That it was common that a person would go ahead and drink with his food. In other words, we're both saying, When a person would eat, it was common that a person would drink as well. However, interestingly enough, when a person was drinking, right? Let's say a person was just stopped drinking truma wine. So it was uncommon for a person to eat while they were sitting down to dafka drink. But the Gemara said, nevertheless, kamash malon, that we employ this concern in both cases. Good. V'haba rosh of ruba b'mayim shuvin. So let's listen to this case. Now, this actually becomes a bit more halacha l'maisa, as we're going to see. What about one who brings his head and the majority of his body under drawn water? The Rebbe says, just to understand what drawn water means. So drawn water, essentially, again, is any non-rainwater. It's not a perfect definition, but that's mayim shuvin. So what does that mean? A person goes ahead. Just to illustrate this, I go ahead and I turn on the sink, and I go ahead, or I turn on the shower for that matter, and I go ahead and I bring the majority of my head and the majority of my body underneath the water. So suddenly, again, I'm tamei. To which the Gemara says, what does this mean? Now, again, when we say tamei, it's tamei to convey tuma to truma. So if you were to take a shower, according to this, and then touch truma, you would make the truma into a shlishi latuma. You'd make it possible. So the Gemara says, my time agaza b'rabbanan tuma. Why did the rabbis legislate in this case? This is fascinating. Amar Rabbi Amar Avasi, listen to this. Shebetchila hayu tovin b'mei ma'ara u'michunasin usruchin. So we'll say, so remember again, the mikvaos of yesteryear were not exactly the mikvaos of today. So it used to be, what would you tovel in? You would tovel in a mikvah that had 40 sa'ah of collected rainwater. But very often people found this in pools and caves. And the water itself was disgusting. Rashi says over here, hayu tovin b'mei ma'ara sruchin michunasin. Literally, they would immerse in mei ma'ara, in water in caves, which means they had some type of like hole in the ground of the cave. The cave is not really the relevant piece over here. The idea is they would find collected pools of 40 sa'ah of rainwater, and ultimately, again, they would, Rashi says, So leaving aside a zav requires different kinds of immersion. So essentially, people would find so holes in the ground, in caves and other places that had 40 saw of collected rainwater, and they would immerse, because it's a kosher mikvah. The problem is, the water could be disgusting as a result, ultimately, of the cave or whatever else. So what would happen? So we'll say, after they came out of the mikvah, what would they do? They would wash down their bodies with regular water, or i.e. non-rainwater, whatever it is. They had water in their pitcher. They had water from somewhere else. They would wash off after going to the mikvah. So the Gemara says, so what happened? Hischilu va'asom keva. Hischilu, they did this va'asom keva. It then became a fixed practice, that this became the norm. People would go to the mikvah, immerse themselves in the cave waters. And again, when I say cave, please understand, cave is not the ikar over here. The idea is they find these bodies of water, which were kind of disgusting. They would immerse in it, they'd come out, and afterwards they'd wash themselves off. And they made this a fixed practice. Gazru aleim tuma. The rabbi said, if you go ahead and you wash yourself with mayim shuvin, drawn water, after going to the mikvah, ultimately, again, you are tamei. You are tamei. Now, Rabbi say, I want to be clear. Now, remember, the rabbis are imposing a lesser form of tuma, right? It only means that if you were to go ahead and touch truma, sahaloch alamaisa, again, you would make it a shlishi, but nevertheless, there it goes there. So the Gemara says, what does that mean, ma'ikev? What does that mean they made the washing off after the mikvah fixed practice? Amr Abai, this is incredible. Shayu Omrim, lo elu metarin, ela elu ve'elu metarin. Because Abaye said, what ended up happening is, the process of immersion evolved. And what happened is, people would immerse in these somewhat yucky, as a technical term, yucky bodies of water, and they would go ahead and then come out, be a bit fashmutzed, wash off afterwards. And people said that essentially, what does tevila mean? Tevila means immersing yourself in this less than optimal body of water and then washing yourself afterwards. That whole thing together, that's called tevila. And they made the washing after the immersion part of the fixed process of going to the mikvah. So the Gemara says, Amar li Abaye, may nafkamina. Hakatav li b'hanaf. So Rava says, who cares? I mean, what does it matter? Let people say whatever they want. As long as they're going to the mikvah, that's the ikr. So the Gemara says, Ela Amar Rava, shei omrim lo elamitarin, ela elamitarin. The problem came up because people began to actually think that it's not the waters of the mikvah that are mitahir you, rather it's the shower you take afterwards that's mitahir you. That's when the mindset became fundamentally dangerous. The moment that the rabbis, Rashi said over here, if you look at the first wide line of Rashi, Ela Elu Mitarin, V'chashinon Dilma Asi Lebatule Toras Mikva, V'tovin B'shuvin V'atora Amra Achmayon Bar Mikva. The rabbis were actually concerned about, say, that what? That people will just simply negate the concept of mikva. They're going to negate the concept of mikvah, and they're just going to think that taking a shower is enough. When the rabbis saw this, they felt the need to legislate, to step in and to say no. Step in and to say no. That ultimately, again, no showering after the mikvah. And if you go ahead and you shower after the mikvah, then what? Then ultimately you contract a lesser from Torah. We'll say, this, by the way, is halacha lamaisi even today. So today when a woman goes to the mikvah, the halacha is that she does not shower after the immersion. She showers before the immersion, prepares herself before the immersion, but halacha lamaisa does not shower after immersion. Obviously, if there are extenuating circumstances, that's something different. But lamaisa, all based on this rabbinic enactment. The idea being lest people come to think, as they used to think, that it's the shower that really affects the Tara. Chazal saw this, and therefore it wasn't enough just to tell people, don't shower. They had to be gozer some level of tumah if a person were to shower after the mikvah. Pretty incredible. V'tar shenafalav rosh avru v'shlosh alugin mayim. Similarly again, but say a person is totally tar. Totally tar. But listen to this. 3 lugin of drawn water, i.e. non, right, drawn water, pour on him. So we'll say, so for argument's sake, a person's tahar, it's a hot day, he goes in and he pours 3 lugin of water over him, suddenly he's tameh. Now again, a smaller form of tumah, only the ability to make truma into a shlishi, nevertheless, he is tameh. My time a gozer be rabbanon tumah, so why did the rabbanon, why were they gozer tumah in this case? D'iloha, lo kaimaha. Ultimately, you're going to both say, because if you don't enact this enactment, then the other one will not be followed as well. In other words, you're both say, this, the Gemara's understanding, these two enactments are connected. So essentially what the rabbis wanted to show was that taking a shower, right, pouring three log of water over yourself has the ability ultimately to go ahead and create rabbinic tumah. And by enacting that, that safeguarded the takana by the mikvah. The ikr is really the takana of the mikvah. Chazal were concerned that if people are showering after the mikvah, that ultimately, again, they may come to think that it's the showering that ultimately creates the tara. So in order to, and without mikvah is the cornerstone. You know, people say for us, so mikvah is a function of tara samishpacha, family purity today. But mikvah is so much more. Mikvah is at the cornerstone. Mikvah is the foundation of our entire concept of Tara. When Chazal felt that there was something that put that at risk, they felt the need to step in. So therefore they were gozer on 3 lugin of water falling on a person that he becomes tameh, in order to safeguard the takana regarding mikvah. The sefer my tameh gozer b'rabanan, so this is amazing. Next, if you touch parchment of a sefer, whether it's, remember, a scroll, so whether that's a sefer Torah, or one of their other sfarim, let's say of Tanakh or of Nach, I should say, if you touch the parchment, your hands become a sheni, your hands become tame. And if you were to then take those same hands and touch truma, you would make the truma into a shlishi. So why is this? The Gemara Samra Mesharshia is incredible. Shevetchila hayu matznin es ochlin the truma itzel sefer Torah. But it used to be that they would store truma in the Aron Kodesh. It's beautiful. They would store truma in the Aron Kodesh, in the Ark, next to the Sefer Torah. But there was a problem. What happened? Va'amru hai kodesh v'hai kodesh. And for good reason. They would say the Torah is holy, and what? And the truma is holy. So therefore it makes sense to go ahead and store truma next to the Sefer Torah. Aye, what happened? Kevan dekachazu dekasal de psida gazu be'rabanan tuma. But say, what happened? Mice got into the Aron Kodesh, began to nibble on the truma. And once the mice began to nibble on the truma, they began to nibble on the parchment as well, and ultimately again go ahead and obviously ruin the Svarim. So Chazal therefore wanted to stop this practice. It's interesting. Apparently human nature is, you can't just tell people not to do stuff. Telling them not to do stuff, I guess, doesn't really work. Instead, what you have to do is, you have to impose repercussions and ramifications. So Chazal could have just said, please don't put Truma in the ark. But that didn't work. So instead, what they said is, if you go ahead and you touch the parchment, your hands become tameh. And if your hands become tameh, you make your truma pasul. Which Rabbah says, so if you're keeping your truma next to your sefer, that's a bad idea. Because if you inadvertently touch the sefer while putting in or putting out, or taking out your truma, you've just ruined your truma. So by imposing tuma, when a person touches a sefer, the Chazal ensured that people will not store their truma next to their sefer Torah, and therefore ultimately again prevented the mice from nibbling on the parchment. Incredible. Life would be so much easier if we just listened. Right? If we just listened and we just did what we're supposed to do, and we don't really need all these gzeras. Okay, good. Vayadayim v'neishayadayim askani yosein. Suppose, I'm sorry, vayadayim, hands. So then Rabbi will say, stam hands. We assume stam yadayim shni yosein. Stam hands, right? The person's hands are generally considered to be a sheni l'tuma. Why is that? Mipnei shehayadayim askani yosein. Because Rabbi will say, literally means the hands are busy. That sometimes a person touches things and they're not aware necessarily of what it is that they're touching. And therefore the concern becomes that halacha l'maaseh, so they end up touching something tamei and they didn't even realize what it was that they touched. Tana, af yadayim haba'os machmos sefer poslos esachuma. So we learned that even yadayim, even hands, that Shabosei, so interestingly enough, the hands themselves seem to convey a tuma, and now the Tana is saying yadayim haboi machmas sefer. So ultimately, again, if the hands go ahead and touch a sefer, postlos es hatshuma. So we'll say two different enactments. One is if you touch a sefer, then ultimately, again, the hands become tame. And now we're seeing that even the hands themselves are considered to be shne asheni l'tuma, second degree tuma, to the point that they have the ability to pasul truma. So now the Gemara is going back and it says, afya dai tana, afya dai habas machma sefer posos as a truma. Hands that touch the parchment of a sefer have the ability to go ahead and pasul truma. Mishum d'Rabbi Parnach. And I will say this is based on a statement of Rabbi Parnach. Rabbi Parnach, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Ha'ochis sefer Torah arum, Nikbar Aram. But say if a person literally touches a Sefer Torah, which is unclothed, which is a way of saying a person touches a Sefer without the covering. They touch the parchment directly. Such a person is buried unclothed. What does that mean? Aram Sakadaitcha? Could it mean that literally a person is buried unclothed? Rather, what it means is a person who touches the parchment of a Sefer Torah is buried naked without mitzvahs. Below mitzvah, what does that mean? Because I touch the parchment of a Sefer Torah, I lose all of my mitzvahs. Does that make sense? The Gemara says, I'm sorry, Ela ima arum below osa mitzvah. Rather, what it means is as follows. It means I lose out. I'm buried naked, literally or without that one mitzvah. In other words, I'll say, even though that when a person was touching the Sefer, he was learning Torah. And learning Torah, of course, is an incredible zechus. But at the end of the day, if a person touched the parchment, he loses out the touching of the parchment, which is considered to be a lack of kavod for the Torah and a disregard for the enactment of the rabbis. Such a person loses out on that privilege, on that mitzvah of learning. Good. So says the Gemara, hey, gazer v'resha. So Rabbah says, so now we ask, ultimately again, which of these two enactments was enacted first. So we'll say, so essentially what you see over here is we have two enactments regarding hands, right? One is that hands themselves are a sheni. The second enactment is that if you touch parchment of a sefer, your hands become a sheni and you have the ability to go ahead and invalidate truma. So the shaila now is, which one was enacted first? What we call stam yadayim, or hands that touch a parchment. So the Gemara says, Ilema hagazer bereisha. If you want to say that the first thing that Chazal legislated was stam yadayim, right, that ultimately, again, that hands, unwashed hands, are tame, and therefore, if you touch truma, the truma becomes pasul. If that was the first enactment, amadeis, kevan, the hach gazer bereisha, ha su lamali. So Rabbi say, if that was the first gezerah, right, if the first gezerah was a gezerah on yadayim, a gezerah on hands, right, to ultimately tell me that stam yadayim are going to be tame, so if that's true, then what? Then why do you have to legislate regarding hands that touch a Sefer Torah? In other words, I will say, if just understand the flow of here, if Chazal are legislating that stam yadayim shniyosim, right, unwashed hands, are considered to be a sheni latuma, then there is no need for any additional legislation regarding touching parchment. Right, at the end of the day, the hands are already tame. So the Gemara says, Ella hach gazer bereisha vahadir gazer bekulo yadayim. So I'll say, it must be that what? It must be actually that the first enactment was that when you touch the parchment of a sefer, the hands become a sheni. And that was legislated in order to prevent people from storing truma next to a sefer Torah, as we saw before. After that was enacted, at some later point in time, the rabbis expanded hand tuma and said stam yadayim, any unwashed hands, are assumed ultimately again to be a sheni latuma, and if they touch truma, they invalidate the truma. So the progression is, first came the enactment that if hands touch parchment, they could convey tuma to truma, that being legislated in order to prevent people from storing truma next to a sefer Torah, and then enactment number two was on just stam hands, regular unwashed hands, are sheni latuma. Beautiful. Utvul yom. So Tvul yom goes ahead and conveys tuma to truma. So the Gemara says Tvul yom doraisu. Tvul yom is not a rabbinic enactment. That's a biblical idea that a Tvul yom goes ahead and conveys tuma. That a Tvul yom conveys tuma ultimately to truma. Dichsiv uba shemesh v'tayer. To which the Gemara says, you're right. Sami mikan Tvul yom. All right, that was easy. Take Tvul yom out of the list. Right, Tvul yom doesn't belong here. Beautiful. Next. And if you have food items which became tummy through contact with liquids, the Gemara says, "Bemashkin demai." What type of mashkin? What type of liquids invalidated this food? So we'll say, if you want to say that it's a liquid that came in contact with a sheretz. Remember again, sheretz are creepy, crawly things, rodents which can be tuma. So if you want to say, I'm talking about a case over here of where I have liquid that came in contact with the sheretz. And then ultimately, again, a food came in contact with that liquid. That's how it's becoming tamei. So the Gemara says, "Doraisa ninu." That's biblical. That's not rabbinic. Because the pasuk over here quotes, "V'chol mashke asher yishasa ela b'mashkin haba in machmas yadayim." Rather, what you have to say is what Rabbi was saying. That ultimately, again, this is a case of where liquid was touched by unwashed hands. So I didn't wash my hands. I touched the liquid. Remember, as we've seen before, yadayim are tame. Therefore, when I go ahead and I touch a liquid with unwashed hands, I convey tuma to those unwashed hands. Then what happens? That liquid then goes ahead and comes in contact with a food item. That's the rabbinic tuma. So the Gemara says, and why do we do that? Ugzira mishum mashkin habo and machmas sheretz. So good, beautiful. So what we do over here is as follows. We say that if liquid comes in contact with, with unwashed hands, I touch liquid, that liquid becomes tame. Let me say it differently. I touch liquid, that liquid becomes tame, that liquid then comes in contact with a food, that food is now tame, the truma is now tame. Right? Why? This is a rabbinic enactment. What's the issue of the rabbinic enactment? Where goes there in that case to prevent you from coming to the case of liquid that comes in contact with the sheretz that then comes in contact with food. Because the sheretz liquid case, that is a biblical case. So we enact the rabbinic prohibition in order to safeguard the biblical one. Beautiful. Vakilim shenitmu b'mashkin, and utensils that became tame through contact with tame, with impure mashkin liquids. Kilim didu mashkin demai. So we'll say, what type of mashkin, what type of liquids are we talking about over here? Says Vigimara Ilim Babamashkin Dizov, if you want to say that it's some type of liquid from the Zov, Dorais Ininu. We'll say that's biblical in nature. So ultimately again, the Gemara says, because the Pasuk says Vichy Yarokazov Batar. So remember again, anything that comes from a Zov ultimately again is going to mashabiyat tar timesilacha. We'll say anything ultimately again that in other contexts might be tar will become tame ultimately again by the Zav. Rashi says mashabiyat tar timesilacha. If you're talking about ultimately what? If you're talking about kalim that became tame with some type of liquid that came from the Zav, that is an Isr Doraisa. Or I should say, that's not Isr, that's Tuma Doraisa. Elo, b'mashkin ha-bo'in machmas sheretz. Rather, you have to talk about the fact that it is a situation, ultimately again, of a liquid that came in contact with a sheretz. The rabbis say, now this is very important. Ultimately, again, remember, there's a distinction in Hilchos Tuma between utensils and between food. Food is more receptive to sheretz Tuma, and ultimately, again, utensils are less receptive to sheretz Tuma. So the idea over here, says the Gemara, is that we're talking about a utensil that came in contact with mashkin that came from a sheretz, and therefore we'll legislate in that case that if the mashkin that came in contact with the sheretz came in contact with a kli, that creates rabbinic tuma. And why do we legislate that rabbinic tuma? To safeguard you against the case of biblical tuma. What's the case of biblical tuma? That would be a case, ultimately, again, of some type of liquid. The fluid that comes from the Zav and then comes in contact with the utensil that would render the utensils impure, tame, on a biblical level. Beautiful. Via Daim. So we'll say, now let's go back for just a moment. So now one of the enactments we had over here was Yadayim. And we had two halachas regarding Yadayim. Number one, that's Stam Yadayim, right? Regular unwashed hands. Your hands are a sheni. So you take your unwashed hands, you touch Truma. Ultimately, again, the Truma becomes pasul. So the Gemara, and then second idea was that if hands touch parchment, ultimately, again, they become tamei as well. But let's focus on the first, yadayim, stam yadayim. What we call stam yadayim, just regular unwashed hands, are considered to be a sheni l'tumah. So the Gemara says, tamide shana vehilo gazer. So we'll say, now remember, these are the 18 enactments. And if you remember again from the Mishnah, these enactments were made in the attic of Hananya ben Chizkiya. And ultimately, again, who was there? Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel were there. So the students of Shammai, the students of Hillel, were part of this legislation. To which the Gemara says, is that true? V'yadayim tamidei Shammai v'Hillel gazer? Shammai v'Hillel gazer. They both say, the enactment regarding Yadayim, regarding hands, was not an enactment made by the students of Shammai and Hillel, but rather, again, that was made by Shammai and Hillel themselves. This sanya, for we learned, Yosi ben Yo'ezer ish tzereda, V'yosi ben Yochanan ishu shalayim, gazru tuma al eretz ha'amim, va'al kli zchuchis. Both say, number of very interesting enactments. Yosi, right? Yosi ben Yo'ezer and Yosi ben Yochanan, they made the following enactments. Number one, gazru tuma al eretz ha'amim. They're both say, any land outside of Eretz Yisrael has rabbinic tuma. Now remember again, why did they impose blanket tuma on all of Chutz La'aretz, all of the diaspora? Because outside of Eretz Yisrael, they were not as careful with marking graves. And therefore, there was a concern that because graves often were not marked, you have to be concerned for the presence of graves anywhere and everywhere. Therefore, they imposed a blanket rabbinic tuma on Chutz La'aretz. Va'al kli zchuchis. They were also gozer that glass has the ability to go ahead and contract tuma, because then we're going to say glass is not written in the Torah. So because of that, we're not sure what to do ultimately again with this material. They were gozer that glass can contract tuma. Shimon ben Shetach tikin ksuv l'isha. So Shimon ben Shetach went ahead and enacted the concept of a ksuva. Now what this means over here is what he enacted specifically was, it used to be that a husband would go ahead and say to his wife, here's your ksuva, and you're going to collect your ksuva from field A. And then what would happen when he would go ahead and get angry at her? He would divorce her and say, fine, just take the field and go, right? Take home, take the deed and go. What Shimon Shetach did is he made the ksuva lien devolve upon all property. What that makes it a little bit more difficult to do is untangle the financial interests of the husband and the wife in the event of divorce. And Shimon ben Shetach did that so that people should not be quick to divorce. Divorce should be a little bit more complicated, and halacha lemaisa require a bit more time to undergo this process. with the hope that over time cooler heads prevail and the divorce doesn't happen. So it's not that Shem and Shetach instituted the concept of ksuva, which is right, the obligation that a husband has towards his wife. That was instituted earlier. He changed the financial mechanism. Before him, you could identify one piece of property and there is no lien against anything else. He said, no, the lien devolves upon everything, making divorce much more complicated. The gazer tuma akli matachos. And ultimately, again, he was gozer. Tuma on metal utensils. Now, we're going to see what that means. He was gozer tuma, meaning metal utensils were already tame. So the Gemara says, Shammai v'Hillel, gozer tuma al yadayim. So Shammai and Hillel, they went ahead and they were gozer. They enacted hand tuma. So we'll see, what do you see from here? You see from here that it's Hillel and Shammai that made the gzera, that yadayim are tame, not their students. To which the Gemara says, "V'chitema Shammai v'siyato Hillel v'siyato." So Rabbi says, maybe what it means is Hillel together with his students and Shammai together with his students. But that's not true. V'ha Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel Yud Ches Davar Gazru Obi Yud Ches Nechlaku. They went ahead, they Shammai v'Hillel legislated 18 things, and they disagreed in 18 matters. Those are the students. V'ilu Hillel v'Shammai Lo Nechlaku Ela Begimel Makomos. But amazing enough, Rabbi said Hillel and Shammai only had three disagreements. Damar Rav Huna, Bikimo Makomos Nechlaku, the Sulo. So Rabbi said, isn't this incredible? You know, we often think of Hillel and Shammai as the paradigmatic example of people who argue about everything. But amazingly enough, Hillel and Shammai themselves only disagreed on three things. That was all. The rest they agreed on. The Talmidim, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, disagreed on many other things. So the Gemara says, V'chitema, Asa inhu gazra litlos, va'asu tamidav v'gazra lisrof. So maybe what happened is as follows. Maybe you're right. It was Hillel and Shammai who made the enactment on hands, on yadayim, that if ultimately, again, hands touch truma, then ultimately, again, they will make truma pasul, because hands are a sheni l'tuma. But maybe what Hillel and Shammai did was as follows. They were gozer litlos. Litlos means that if you take your unwashed hands and you touch truma, you just can't use it. You can't burn it. You can't destroy it, but you also can't eat it. You just have to leave it. And maybe their students subsequently came along and intensified the enactment and said that no, the truma must be burnt. I the ha'amar ilfa, that's not true. Yadayim tchilasan gzeirasan l'sreifa. It's not true. From the beginning, the enactment regarding yadayim was that if you eat truma with unwashed hands, sahalach l'maysa, ultimately again, the truma is burned. So what happens? So I'll say, so remember again, how do we reconcile this? Because it sounds like it wasn't Beis Shammai Beis Hillel who made the enactment regarding hands, but rather it was Hillel and Shammai who made the enactment. So it says the Gemara, rather what happens is incredible. Asu inhu gazer v'lo kiblu minayu. Asu talmidayu gazer v'kiblu minayu. To which the Gemara says, you're right. What happened is Hillel and Shammai were actually the first ones to go ahead and legislate regarding hands. And they said that halacha l'maisa, if you go ahead and your hands are a sheni, and if you touch truma, you pasul truma. But here's something amazing. When Hillel and Shammai legislated the halacha, it was not accepted. It was not accepted for whatever the historical reason. The practice never stuck. No one ever accepted it. The Talmidim Beis Shammai then came along later on, reintroduced it, and this time for some reason, I don't know what the societal factors are, is it was accepted. So I will say what the Gemara is ultimately saying is that halacha l'maisa, it was Hillel and Shammai who made the gzira bayadayim, but it wasn't accepted when they made it. The Talmidim then felt that they could reintroduce it, and ultimately, again, this time, it stuck. Beautiful. I will say, we'll stop over here. I just want to share with you, I know it's a little bit late, but I just want to share with you a quick idea from the parsha.